Well, I want to thank ACCNC, which I told somebody that I was speaking at the ACCC. And they said, well, that's an interesting thing that they're going to be getting involved in the modern slavery. But maybe we need to get them involved in the modern slavery. So we'll work on that. The consumers do need their rights. But I also, I want to thank Stephen and all the co-sponsors, the work that everybody's doing, whether it's the folks over at Stop the Traffic, Anti-Slavery, everybody together coming to get to really show us kind of the way forward and what we need to be doing here in Australia. As I've been over the last years, been able to do these things around the world. I also, as has already been done, I want to, by coming across the ocean, I want to respectfully ask permission to come in to this land from not only the Aboriginal people who were here, the First Nations people, the Torres Straits people, but also those who came here not knowing what was going to happen to them, the people of the South Sea Islands who were blackbirded in numbers that we often don't talk about, even as we start to commemorate the people who settled this land so many years ago. The people who came here scared and alone, maybe for something as little as stealing a handkerchief or talking back to somebody in the aristocracy in the British Islands, and all of those people. Also, the people who are here today, who are wondering if anyone is listening, who are wondering if anybody is looking for them. I worked for the only member of the United States Congress for whom Martin Luther King actually campaigned. John Conyers, Chairman Conyers, who was a giant of our Congress, once said that this modern slavery, this human trafficking that we work on now, is a debt that we owe, written in the blood of those who lived and died for those hundreds of years in slavery. And how would we be able to look them in the eye if we were not working to make sure that it was not happening today? And that's something that I think impels all of us, especially as we commemorate the transatlantic slave trade. Now, clearly, the transatlantic slave trade was not the only slave trade. It was the big slave trade, however, of the globalized, modern, industrialized world, the post-Enlightenment world, in which people felt that they actually had to take the time, from a theological perspective, to justify why they could do this to people, as opposed to it simply being the social structure that they had built their entire economy and their entire societies around. And so you had people, and I will say that I'm not currently serving in our government. There was an election, I served President Obama. We have the system where you leave when your boss is no longer president. I'm not currently in the diplomatic service, but I like to think I'm still a little bit of a diplomat, so I will charitably say that there were a number of Christians in the British Empire and in the newly departed part of it in the United States, where I say that we left early enough that the Commonwealth had not yet been formed, and that's the only reason why we're not a member of the Commonwealth. But unfortunately, there were otherwise God-fearing people who thought very seriously about the Bible, thought very seriously about theology, who went out of their way to try to find the few little nuggets in the Bible that they could use to justify this practice. And so not only did you have an economic system that was built around it, not only did you have an entire market system that was built around this trade that we commemorate today, but you ended up having a cultural system and even a religious system. Now, it's interesting to me that a religion that was the hope of the enslaved in its infancy, that slave religion that somehow takes over the most powerful empire in the world because of the truth it told to poor and outcast people, that it then provides, pervertedly, the rationale to enslave others a few thousand years later. It's that religion, though, that actually gave people hope in their time in slavery. It's that religion that people in the United States who were not able to read and write because it was illegal for them to. It's great that there's a picture of Toussaint Louverture. I actually like the fact that it's next to my boss, Barack Obama, because I do think that both of them are almost as provocative of figures for the majority communities in the Americas and elsewhere, 200 years difference. But, you know, after the Haiti revolt, not just in the United States, but in British West Indies and other places, everybody clamped down on the black community. Suddenly, people were being sold away from each other if they looked like they might be leaders. If you were a leader, you were going to get shipped out to some other plantation because they didn't want you to actually be able to lead. Not being able to read and write. And so what did people take solace in? The stories that they were being told. The stories of the Israelites. The stories of Jubilee. The promise of freedom. The promise that there could be something better. And they mixed it with their old religions. A lot of people don't necessarily realize that the old black spiritual in the United States of Ezekiel saw the wheel way up in the middle of the air with the groups and the communities in their outdoor churches dancing in circles around each other comes directly from the Yoruba religion. And you see what looks like a chariot wheel across with a circle around it in the parts of Africa that people were kidnapped from. And they found in Christianity something that spoke to them about what they had been stolen from, but also something that kept them going. And that's one of the reasons why the black church becomes the place of resistance. It becomes the place of banding together in the United States. It becomes an inspiration to even those of us who are not in the black community. I'm very proud to be from the Mexican-American community. My family colonized by the United States in the 1846 war. And so I feel very strongly when I hear the stories of dispossession of the Aboriginal peoples with their land having been taken away. But I also recognize that we had only been on that land for 300 or so years, and we were living right next to the people who had been there long before we ever showed up, with an awful lot of intermarriage, with an awful lot of cultural contact. But there was something about America coming in with those racial attitudes, with those racial ideas, even though the slave trade was over officially in 1808. In 1846, 1848, when my family became American, we immediately said, well, we want to be with the people who don't own slaves. And incorporating in the newly conquered parts of Mexico and the idea of whether they would be slave states or not was one of the flashpoints for our Civil War. A reckoning that had been predicted by Thomas Jefferson, the architect of our independence with the Declaration of Independence. He, a man who owned slaves, whose life partner was his, get this, wife's sister, who was also a slave who he owned, and the mother of his black children. He owned more than 200 slaves. He had a nail factory where he specifically made sure that the child slaves were working because in letters that he wrote, little fingers were more nimble. And yet he was also the architect of the idea that all men are created equal, that America could be something that was not tied by the monarchy, that America was a place where people could be everything. And I don't know enough to say one way or the other what that relationship was or wasn't. But he wrote at one point that America and slavery was like somebody riding a wolf, holding it by the ears, unable to either let go or to keep riding, because either one would come to ruin. That ruin gets deferred until our Civil War. People talk about, you know, why is it that the United States seems to be so fixated on human trafficking, on slavery? Well, we have at least a million reasons. A million Americans who died as we tried to sort that out. And thank goodness that we sorted out the way that we did. But again, Toussaint Louverture, why it's so important that he's on the poster board back then. Southern Americans, I've heard several people since I've been in Australia saying that the Deep North is the Deep South, as far as Queensland and the Southern United States.
That's right.
And you know, blackbirding up there, and what we even see now with some of the things that happen in the agriculture, very similar to what we're seeing with the Mexican community, with the Haitian community, with other immigrant communities who are picking our food, putting those things on our table. And we have to be asking ourselves in the United States. We also have to be asking ourselves, well, why is it that the exact same plots of land now are where we are discovering modern slavery cases, where we had antebellum slavery with black folks, and even more troubling, debt bondage two generations later, as people kept trying to figure out a way to keep black folks on the land, keep them working. Our civil rights movement broke that system, and it gave them an opportunity to get jobs in town, to get jobs in the information economy, to get government jobs, etc. And unfortunately, a lot of the unscrupulous farmers, I'm going to say something in Australia now and see if you recognize it, but I won't try the accent. Dodgy labor hire, there's agents, I think, is the word.
Yeah.
So dodgy labor hire. Well, unscrupulous farmers and what we would say bad crew leaders, basically having to go out and find new people to exploit in those fields. But back up to Toussaint Louverture, in the early 1800s, the fear of the black rebellion, you had parts of the United States that were 90% black, with a very scared 10% white community that was making all the money. This is in South Carolina, which was one of the most bellicose parts of the United States, calling for war in the Civil War to defend their way of life, their ability to enslave. The United States Civil War was not about states' rights to come up with new ways to have you register your buggy with the state. It wasn't about coming up with new ways to have public education schemes in the state, or back then, I guess we didn't have retirement schemes. I was in Parliament this afternoon for a question hour, so I learned more about the supposed retirement and which party is horrible. Evidently, each of them, depending on who you which side of the House you listen to. It wasn't about that. It was about states' rights to enslave people. And a lot of it was that the Southern whites were afraid that there was going to be a slave rebellion, like there had been in Haiti. And at the end of the day, our Civil War proved them right, because by the end of the war, the American army was made up of white folks from all over who cared about this, but also 300,000 escaped slaves wearing the American uniform, fighting for the federal troops, for the first time being incorporated into our country, into our army, for then the first time after that being able to be brought into the government. This is why it's so interesting to me when we look at how we commemorate the transatlantic trade within the UN system, because it doesn't simply say, let's look at the trade and then have it end on a particular date. It's that notion of social integration. It's not just people being freed by Abraham Lincoln making a declaration. It's about people taking up the sword themselves, running away from their masters and fighting for their people, fighting for themselves. A few weeks ago, I was in Los Angeles meeting with one of the groups that is the gold standard, Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking. And one of the women who I was talking to, who is an escaped slave herself, a woman who took almost 6 months painstakingly to go when the bosses weren't looking and to learn a new word in an Indonesian English dictionary and then try to remember that word and write it down on a note so that she could throw it over the back fence, so that somebody could come and know that she was alive. Not even to rescue her, just to know that she was alive so she wouldn't die there. She said to me the other day that the biggest success that the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking is having on reincorporating people, restoring them, providing them with the services that they need to live the life that they deserve, are the people who ran on their own, the people who sought help on their own. Not the people who passively were rescued. Not the people who you come bursting through the door and they say, oh, thank you, which doesn't happen, by the way. That's in movies. I love those movies, but it doesn't happen in real life. And part of that is because they have already made the mental journey to freedom. Frederick Douglass, who is, just as the UN in many ways, is born of Dr. Bunch and his example in literally the founding years of the United Nations. Frederick Douglass, for us in the United States, is kind of Dr. King and President Kennedy and everybody else all kind of wrapped up into one. He's also one of the first African-American ambassadors in the United States State Department. And so for those of us, whether it's indigenous, African-American, or Hispanic-American, he's kind of our, for lack of a better word, patron saint, in that he was also the first black ambassador the United States sent to Haiti. Again, very political, because Haiti, that's where those black folks had revolted. Douglass said, and this is a man who became our greatest orator, our greatest public speaker, our greatest writer, a man who lived and was brought up in a situation where he could have been beaten, jailed, or killed if they had found out that he was teaching himself to write. Like this woman that I told you about, like Imam Atul, he was sneaking into the library and opening the book and figuring out what had happened. And he ended up becoming one of our most influential, not just abolitionists. He was the man in the room on the second day of the Seneca Falls Conference, which was our first big feminist movement, when the women were getting together and saying, we deserve to have legal rights, independent of our husbands. And they trusted him because he was such a strong supporter. And on the second day, when they let men in, he was the one who said, let's all maybe work on not only getting me the right to vote, but let's work together on all of us getting the right to vote. And on the last day of his life, the last thing that he did was he was the only man on the podium at the National Suffragette Conference in Washington, D.C. He went home to have some dinner, and he was going to go back for the evening festivities. And Susan B. Anthony and all of the other giants of our women's movement suddenly found out that their friend had died of a heart attack before he could come back to the conference. I say all of this so that you can understand a little bit about this man. Frederick Douglass was sent to a slave breaker. A slave breaker is somebody that when you can't get somebody to behave, you send him to that farm. And their job is not really to bring in the crops. Their job, like somebody who would break a horse, is to beat it out of them, to beat the fight out of that, usually man. Well, that didn't work with Frederick Douglass, clearly. Try telling that slave owner 15, 20 years later, when Frederick Douglass is in Abraham Lincoln's office, urging him to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. But I'll tell you this, what Frederick Douglass said, and it's what Imam Atul sees when she's working with newly escaped victims now, it's what I think you're gonna see here in Australia as the Modern Slavery Act passes. Douglass said, I prayed for freedom for my first 20 years, and God never answered until I prayed with my feet. So what does that mean for us now when we're talking about a Modern Slavery Act, when we're talking about modern slavery? President Obama said it perfectly in 2012 during the UN week and in his major speech on this issue, when people were saying, oh my God, you can't talk about slavery. We know it's the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, but it's 6 weeks before you're up for re-election. You can't talk about slavery because people will, I don't know, maybe think that he's black or something, right? I think everybody kind of knew that already about Barack Obama. Well, this is how amazing he was as a president. This is how amazing he was as a man. He basically said, this 150th anniversary of what Abe Lincoln did, this 150th anniversary of what Frederick Douglass worked towards, and what all of those people died hoping for. You hear these stories of people, and we even saw it in the African American Museum in Washington. There's little teeny pocket versions of the Emancipation Proclamation. And the American officers would ride from plantation to plantation, where folks had lived their entire life wondering if they'd ever see their children again, wondering if anything would ever happen, wondering if Jubilee would ever come. And they would get everybody together and they would read this little pamphlet of the Emancipation Proclamation. And so Barack Obama chose, on the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, during UN week, after his speech to the General Assembly, which, you know, you only get a certain amount of time for those, so he came and gave the big long speech at the Clinton Global Initiative. And he rebutted those people who would question, why are we talking about slavery now? Why not call it human trafficking? Why not call it something that makes us more comfortable with it, as opposed to slavery? And he said, if it's a man on a fishing boat who's being beaten and is far from home and helpless, that's slavery. If it's a girl in a brothel who doesn't know whether tomorrow is the day that she gets killed by a client or the day that she is able to go home, that's slavery. If it's the people who are picking our crops to put food on our table and they've had their passport taken, or they're under a visa scheme that the person's hanging over their heads, that's just flat out slavery. It took somebody like Barack Obama, I think, to say that. But the fact that he chose to do that against the advice of his political advisors, 6 weeks out from an election, where his race was going to be an issue, and he knew that. It's because he recognized the truth that Douglas recognized. It's because he recognized the truth that those slave owners who were afraid of that slave rebellion in Haiti recognized, that this injustice cannot and shall not be tolerated. That's why I'm so happy that I'm here in Australia at a time when you're looking at modern slavery legislation. Because just as in the United States, working on human trafficking, working on modern slavery, being a light to the world, sometimes a scold, hope, sometimes a funding opportunity, but by raising this so much in the last few years through our trafficking in persons report, through our diplomacy, through our programming, and hopefully through the cases that we investigate and prosecute and the victims we help at home, we're starting to pay back that debt, a debt that frankly never can be repaid to the millions of people who lived and died in slavery in America. But that's a debt that's owed here in Australia as well. I was at the National Museum on Sunday, and there's a pearl exhibit that is phenomenal. It's a temporary exhibit, so go before they take it away. It's interesting to me how overtly your museum deals with the fact of slavery, indenture, kidnapping, blackbirding, etc., up north. Broome sounds like it was a hell on earth for everybody except for about 25 white families back then. The McRae family is called out by name in the museum. Their ship, the Dawn, going up and stealing people from the Solomons, stealing people from Papua New Guinea, bringing people back. They could call it blackbirding, they could call it indenture, they could call it whatever they wanted to. There's two things that I took from that. One of the pieces of the exhibit says, in effect, no matter how many times we tried to report this, it was never investigated or prosecuted. And the other one, from another ship captain, says, if what the Dawn is doing is not slavery, then what is it? So just as the United States owes this debt to the people who built our country, the enslaved black Africans, who we commemorate today through the transatlantic commemoration, so too does Australia owe that debt to the people who built this country. The other day I was in a meeting and a phone call with the elders. And I've had a chance to tell you a little bit about some of the people who we consider to be our elders, especially Frederick Douglass. His family continues the fight, even today. Nettie Washington Douglass and her son, because they say this is what he would do if he were here. But when I was talking to the elders the other day, Auntie Shireen Malibu from up north said on the phone, "Tell the truth, and we all grow up." That's what we commemorate today. We have to look, we have to remember, and at the end of the day, hopefully together, we can grow up. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much, Lou. Plenty of things to talk about, but what I'm going to propose is that we have a 10-minute break. This time you get a drink and have some cheese, and in that time one of our other guests will arrive, and then we'll continue for a little while. So please stand up, say hello to somebody you don't know, and have a drink. Well, everybody, welcome back. We timed it perfectly, actually, because as we got up to get a drink, Chris walked in. It's my great pleasure now to welcome to this gathering the Honourable Chris Crowther, MP. Chris is Chair of the Foreign Affairs and Aid Subcommittee, responsible for parliamentary inquiry into combating modern slavery. Chris, we're delighted. I know that Parliament is sitting, and you have just left one place, and now you've come to another place. But we're delighted that you have come here, and we're looking forward very much, and we're very appreciative of the hard work that you are doing within Parliament, giving a lead on this. And so it's very important for us, who represent a whole range of constituencies, to be able to hear a little bit about what's happening in Parliament and the proposed legislation and some of the issues that surround that. So I'd like to welcome you, and after you've spoken, we'll have a bit of a Q&A with yourself and Carolyn and Grace.